Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 221, Larry Correa, Part 1. This episode is sponsored by Tracy Falby, author of the fantasy novel Riss Rising. I'm your host, Timothy C. Ward. Advice on writing action from an author who has the real-life Jack Bauer in his back pocket? Yeah, that's why I love Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. That seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding. Oh,
man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by a rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Sci-Fi Publishing.
Hey folks, Timothy C. Ward, listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Welcome back. It's just me again. Hope that's all right with you. Today is Moses' birthday. Happy birthday, Moses. Last I heard, he ate an entire chocolate cake by himself, then went out in his birthday suit and grabbed his 6-foot spear and went hunting in the woods around his house. So we hope his wife finds him eventually. In celebration of Moses' birthday, all people who tweet the show and link with a retweet or hashtag AISFP, we will give you your choice of Moses' novels, The Black God's War, or his newest one, Of Splendor and Ruin, which is a preview to the new trilogy that he's writing, which I believe is novella length, so it's not just a short preview. But you'll get your choice of that in Kindle format. So tweet away. I'll give you until part two comes out on Thursday. So good luck with that. Thanks for supporting the show. In our episode today, Larry Correa, who is releasing his third and final book in the Grimnoir Chronicles, Warbound. That comes out August 6th. So just like when we had with Michael J. Sullivan, authors really benefit from purchases made during the first week. That's sort of how the New York Times bestsellers list is formatted, and it also helps their role with the publisher and future books. As you'll hear at the very end of this episode, Larry is not really want of more book contracts. I think he said 16 books or something already planned to write. So, but anyway, we want to support Larry, and so we're getting this episode out in time for his release of Warbound. Today's episode talks about his Grimnoir Chronicles, which is an alternate history fantasy series in the early 20th century setting when a limited amount of people have very strong magical powers and top-notch writing and action and all that. So since this is book three that's coming out, I wanted to do a show that is somewhat of an introduction to the series, and but we also get some insider information on inspiration for the series for some of his characters, so it's still fun for those that have read up to this point. Also get to talk about action writing, and as I mentioned in the beginning, he has quite the resources, so there is some phenomenal advice on how to make your action real. Our part two I will try and release by Thursday. Usually end up releasing in the evening after I get home from work, so be sure to check in then. Part two is kind of maybe entirely geared towards fans of Larry Correa. At the end of this episode, we talk about his books, all the books that he has planned. And I cut it off there. And then part two starts off with him just talking about the next books that he's got in line. And so there's some really interesting insider info. There's a spoiler about 11 minutes in for people that haven't read up on the Monster Hunter International series. Anyway, without further ado, enjoy the show. Thank you for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. I'm your host, Timothy C. Ward. Today we have two people on the line. We have, first off, Larry Correa. Welcome, Larry.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And we also have a friend of mine, Nick Sharps. Say hi, Nick.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
It's a pleasure. Nick is a fellow book reviewer over at SF Signal and is a huge Larry Correa fanboy. I've been hearing about his appreciation for a while. So when I had the chance to interview Larry, I thought it would be fun to have Nick come on and show us his expertise here with his Larry Correa knowledge. So, Nick, why don't you get us started?
All right. Well, the first question I had really was about your influence, Larry, for the creation of the Grimoire Chronicles, because I know a bit about your inspiration behind Monster Hunter and how, you know, you're a big B-movie fan, but I don't think I've ever read what inspired Hard Magic.
Okay, this one's a little bit weird, actually, how it came about, because I joke that the Grimoire Chronicles is my series that was written entirely out of spite. Well, what happened, I was at LTUE, which is Life, University, and Everything. It's a big writing conference held in Utah every year. And it's a great big convention, but it's all writing. It's all business of writing, all for aspiring writers. It's not really a fan convention. Very, very hardcore. And at this point in time, I think I just had Monster Hunter International out, and I think Monster Hunter Vendetta was coming out or had just come out. And so all I had was the two books. And I was on a panel with a bunch of pretty well-known authors. I believe we had Lee Modisette on the panel, and we had Brandon Sanderson. And I think the other person was Dave Wolverton. So, you know, some pretty heavy-hitting, well-known authors. And somebody, one of the aspiring authors in the audience, and mostly college students, raises his hand, and he asks this question. And I don't even know what it was. I can't even remember what the question is now. He asks this question about world building. I look at Brandon, who's moderating, and I go, oh, I got this. I got a great answer for this. And I start to answer. Well, the student cuts me off. He cuts me off. He goes, hey, you know, you're just a contemporary fantasy author. I want to hear what the epic fantasy authors have to say. And he said that. I was like, you little, and it's like, you know, a bunch of bad words formed in my mind. I was like, jerk. And so, you know, somebody else answered the question. And afterwards, I look at Brandon and I go, you know what? I'm going to write an epic fantasy. What makes something an epic fantasy? He says, well, you know, it's usually a big world, lots of characters, a lot of world building, usually a big sweeping plot arc. And so he went over kind of the rules. And so I went home and I decided I was going to brainstorm this. And Mike Kupri, the friend of mine who I wrote Dead Six with, was at my house, and we were brainstorming an epic fantasy. And at the time, my son was reading Noir Spider-Man. It was like alternate Spider-Man. And I looked at that, and, you know, Spider-Man's there wearing a fedora. And I thought, wow, you know, that was a really cool time period. So then Mike started brainstorming basically noir, airship, steampunk, dieselpunk, fedora-wearing, magical-powered superhero stuff. And so I set out to write an epic fantasy, and it turned into an alternate history, the 1930s superhero story. So that's... I am so bad at sticking to a genre. That's where the Grimnoir Chronicles came from.
So book three, Warbound, is coming out in August.
Yeah, it's going to be out here pretty quick. The E-Arc is out from Bayon now. So really, really excited. Really excited for this book. Nick, you've read it, right? You've read the E-Arc,
absolutely.
Haven't you?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I had a lot of fun with it. That was a fun one.
So for those that haven't started reading this series yet, give us an introduction to some of the heavy hitters and the conflict between them.
The main struggle in the book is between a secret society. Let me backtrack a little bit. Basically, it's just like our world up until the 1850s. And in the 1850s, magical powers begin to show up amongst certain people. And as time goes on, the number of people with magical powers has slowly grown until it's about one, and by the 1930s, it's about 1 in 100 people in the world, with about 1 in 1,000 being capable of some truly impressive things. And everybody has basically one area of the law of physics they can tweak. Which is another thing, too, because it's a fantasy novel, but I really got kind of into the science and the physics of it, because it's actually kind of a science fiction novel, but like I said, I can't stay in one genre. But, so, the book is basically about a handful of main characters who have joined this secret society, basically, that their goal is to protect magical people from the world, and to protect the world from magical people. And I'm also kind of a history nut, and the 1930s was a really tumultuous time frame of governments, you know, really trying to control people around the world, and I get into that a little bit, but the main power struggle is between my alternate version of Imperial Japan, which is led by the world's most powerful wizard, and it's a great, 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 awesome antagonist, and this magical secret society, and then behind the scenes, there's basically a giant supernatural force at play also that really, as the series wraps up, you kind of figure out what it is and they face off against it. Most of the book is told to the perspective of two people. Jake Sullivan, he's a kind of your stereotypical hard-boiled detective character from that era. He's a war hero from World War One, ex-con, who actually, he's what's called a heavy, which is someone that can control gravitational force and direction and pulls. And then the other main character is this teenage girl named Faye, who's an Oki, or your Grapes of Wrath. She's actually kind of psychotic, and she's the most powerful wizard in the world. So it's a fun series. Got a lot of critical acclaim. This is my series that's actually won some awards. It's a blast. So it's just big, shooty fun, and I mean, we have teleporting magic ninja fights on top of flaming pirate dirigibles. It's completely crazy, but it came out really good. So despite the pitch and how odd it sounds, it's actually a really good series. So one of my favorites.
I've gotten a good chunk into hard magic, and I noticed a theme of good versus evil. And I'm just curious how you tackle that in your storytelling.
I like having good versus evil themes. I think in a lot of fiction, it's fun to get into the gray areas and the morally nebulous areas and, you know, your dark anti-heroes and all that stuff. But I think sometimes we get a little too much of that. So I think it's fun to go back to just your good old-fashioned, you know, these are obviously the good guys. These are obviously the bad guys. Their goals are known, and, you know, let's fight it out. And people like that. I think sometimes authors try a little too hard to be edgy, and I think they do that. You know, sometimes the story calls for that nebulousness, but a lot of times it doesn't. And there's nothing wrong with just having a straightforward good versus evil slugfest. Even then, I still try to keep my characters, you know, nuanced as to why they do what they do. I mean, like my villain, I don't like having, you know, mustache twirling evil just for the sake of evil. But as the series goes on, you find out that the chairman, the guy in charge of Japan, who does some horrific evil things, he has a very logically sound reason for what he does. And when you look at it from his perspective, he's the good guy in his own mind. If that means killing, you know, millions of people, hey, that's great, because it's just, you know, you got to break some eggs to do something more important. So, you know, I like having good versus evil in books. I mean, that's kind of a thing with me. I'm pretty straightforward in that respect.
You even have some evil characters that it's like levels of evil. I'm not able to think of the names, but the guy who is able to touch people.
Oh, yeah, the Pale Horse. Yeah. So for people who haven't read it yet, there's, in the series I have the different types of magic power, one of which is referred to the Pale Horse. And it's basically someone who can control disease, and they can cause disease, they can cause illness, and they can make you get sick and kill you. And this dude is when the book, once again, when the book starts, I mean, he comes off as just pure evil, and he is. He's a complete dirtbag, but as the book goes on, you understand the reasoning and the logic of why he's evil. And yeah, he is evil, and, you know, I don't want to, you know, no spoilers here, but by the time you get to the end of the book, you're, when he gets what's coming to him, you're like, yeah, serves you right, jerk face. But you also understand why he did what he did, and part of you is like, yeah, that was horrible and awful, but if I was in his situation, that's a pretty darn good plan. Yeah, and then, you know, I love writing villains. I don't know if that comes across, but I am a huge nerd when it comes to creating bad guys and antagonists.
It definitely comes across.
Well, I just can't stand boring villains. I have a hard time with boring villains. Like in stuff that I read or stuff that I watch, if there's a really boring villain, it kills it for me. I think, you know, the villain is half your story.
I wanted to ask you about the action element. As Nick has said, he thinks you're the best action writer around. So I'm curious how you excel at writing and maybe some of the things that you've learned to improve that area of your writing.
Well, yeah, one of the things I get asked to do when I go to writing symposiums almost always is, you know, Larry, teach a seminar on how to write action. That's kind of my thing that I've gotten a reputation for as being an action writer. Part of it is my background in my own personal life. I was a firearms instructor for about 10 years. I was a competition shooting guy. I was big into self-defense and fighting and all that stuff, and absolutely loved it. And part of that was studying real-life events and what you could learn from the real-life events so that you could, you know, adopt that into your own training curricula. And part of that is talking to a lot of people who've been through things and seeing how it felt, what they experienced, what they went through, the decision-making processes, what adrenaline does to your mind under the effects of, what are the effects of adrenaline on your mind? What are the effects of physical injuries? I mean, I've been through, I write pretty gruesome, violent scenes when people actually, you know, bad things happen to them, physically injuries. I took wound ballistics classes taught by people from the Department of Homeland Security, where it was 10 hours of looking at gunshot wound victims and autopsy slides. And, I mean, so I did this as a career for about 10 years where I just soaked up everything I could about how violence actually works in real life so that I could teach people how to combat it or how to deal with it. As part of that, though, so when I start writing fiction, you know, most writers have never been punched in the face in real life, and so when they write their fiction, you know, they're just kind of making stuff up as they go, but it doesn't feel as visceral, it doesn't feel as real. Basically, for me, is I did it as a job for so long, it became second nature to understand how this stuff works, and so when I write these action sequences in these novels, I try to put as much of that reality in that, basically, if it feels real to people as they read it, then it becomes more plausible and more sensible and more visceral. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of been the goal in my writing action scenes. Plus, I'm a huge gun nut. Like I said, competition shooter, firearms instructor. So, you know, most writers have not shot a gun, or if they have, they've been to the range a few times. So when they write a gunfight, they miss a lot of opportunities to make the gunfight more interesting and more exciting. Being a gun nut, when I write a gunfight, oh man, I've got encyclopedias of useless information to draw upon, you know, stuff that I'm otherwise never going to use in my life ever again, you know, knock on wood. But I'm able to throw that stuff into these fight sequences and make the fight sequences, you know, feel more real to the reader.
I'm curious about adrenaline. Is there a certain time limit of adrenaline that we have? Because, you know, a lot of people write books and it's just an action scene for hours at a time. I'm curious, is there a limit?
Well, actually, yes. Part of it, too, is how much exposure you've had to it and how much there's an old saying of fight like you train and train like you fight. The more you expose yourself to the stress, the more you're able to deal with the stress and internalize it and take advantage of the physiological effects. You'll notice if you've ever had something that scared the crap out of you or you got a real honest-to-goodness adrenaline rush, for about 45 minutes to an hour later, even, you know, 15 minutes, half an hour, depending on your physiology, you're going to start going through like these really bad shakes. That's the adrenaline come down, basically. That's normal. And a lot of people, you know, they leave that stuff out of books. Little things like time dilation. Your conscious mind will begin to compress events. Your short-term memory is actually damaged during an adrenaline dump. Your gross muscle movements will become much stronger, but your complex small muscle movements will become much more difficult. You're going to become clumsy. You're going to become fumbly. But you're going to become stronger. You're not going to notice a lot of things that you would otherwise notice, like physical injuries. A lot of times you will get hurt, and you won't realize it until afterwards because your body's like, we don't have time for that. It's weird. There's a lot of things that happen to you under stress, and if you can convey just a few of those into writing a sequence, as your readers read it, they're going to connotate this stuff to their own lives, and it's going to make your action sequence feel more plausible and more believable to them. I mean, even things like if you've been in a car accident, reading about a car accident from someone who's been in a car accident is a lot different than reading somebody writing a car accident who's never been in one. I mean, you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, fight scene is just the same thing. And don't get me wrong, you don't need to have actually done this stuff. Most writers haven't. I mean, obviously, I've never sword fought a dragon. But I can write a pretty awesome sword fighting a dragon scene just by extrapolating out different things and trying to put the reader into that. Some readers get hung up on not writing action scenes some writers get hung up on not writing action because they haven't done that, so they feel like a poser. Well, that's fine. We write fantasy, we write science fiction. We have never done, and we never will do, a lot of the things we put in books. And writing an action scene is just the same way. I mean, when I was younger, I was real hesitant to write romance. Because, I mean, I've been married for 15 years, okay? I have had one successful relationship in my entire life. I am not the dude to go to for dating advice. And so when I first started writing, I was really super hesitant on that front because I didn't know about it. But here's the thing, as a writer, you fake it till you make it. You know, you do enough research, you learn enough about people to make stuff plausible, and then you stick it in and tweak it until it feels good, until, you know, it entertains readers. So, I mean, I think anybody can write action. It just requires a little bit of homework and a little bit of effort.
Tracy Falby spent 15 years crafting 8 novels in a Riss fantasy world. In the Riss Chronicles, Dri Ban Veda overthrows a goddess, wins the greatest treasure ever, and then must face a reckoning with the great empire of his homeland that he betrayed. In Riss Rising, Amar rises as the unstoppable warlord of Anja. He conquers great cities and gathers armies to take against the ancient and magical realm of Nifal. Readers worldwide have enjoyed Falby's fiction. Teresa H. said, "The Riss are unlike any characters in any other fantasy books I've ever read. Falby invites you to read Riss Rising Book 1, your gateway to a new reading addiction. Download free samples, enjoy bundle discounts, and find links to your favorite ebook retailers at braveluck.com. Do you have any resources that you would recommend for people that want to learn more about adrenaline and combat experience?
Best thing to do is honestly make friends with people who've been there, done that. Find a couple people that you can, you know, that are comfortable talking about their personal experiences and talk to them. That's basically what I did because for me, it was the business I was in. I worked with a lot of people that were, you know, real life bad man pajamas. And so I just had this group of people that I could go to and I would have them read my stuff and be like, no, this doesn't feel real. This doesn't feel plausible because of this, this, and this. Like the harshest one ever is I have my military thriller Dead Six sequel Swords of Exodus. It'll be out in September. And I wrote that with a guy named Mike Cooper. Mike in real life, his day job is he's an EOD technician. That means in the military, he's one of those guys that goes downrange in the big bomb suits and defuses bombs. I mean, like the movie The Hurt Locker. Okay. It's not realistic, but that's what Mike does. Okay. And, you know, I got my technical background. So we wrote this military thriller, and between the two of us, we know our stuff. We know tactics, we know techniques, we know equipment. So we thought, okay, this book is pretty hardcore. Everything in this book is going to be spot on, right? Well, we got a friend of mine to be one of our proofreaders. And I won't reveal his identity, but in real life, he is Jack Bauer. I mean, he is a real-life Jack Bauer. That's his job. He was a lieutenant colonel, Army Special Forces, been everywhere in the world, done everything you think of, and now he is a federal agent that leads a team of guys that do crazy stuff for a living, okay? And so I had my friend read this, and, you know, me and Mike, we know our stuff, right? He comes back with 8 pages of notes on just little things, little details. Do this, do this. We wouldn't do that. I would never do this. Oh, if we're taking over a ship, you wouldn't use explosives below the waterline to get into the engine room. You'd use a Broco torch. And it's like, wow, okay, that's really good to know. So part of it is, as you grow in your writing and you make more acquaintances and you get out to conferences and cons and that kind of thing and you find alpha readers, you will find all sorts of really cool people who have done awesome things with their life that you can learn from and that you can use to bounce this stuff off of. Because, I mean, there's a lot of people that are huge fans and readers that have crazy jobs. And you'll just kind of grow that over time. The internet is a great tool, too, discussion forums. I tell aspiring authors a great one to use is internet gun forums. If you need to know gun particular stuff, join an internet gun forum and post your questions. You go there, you're honest, and, you know, you're open with your agenda. Look, this is what it is. I'm a fiction writer. I'm trying to learn this stuff. You will have tons of people who are readers who want to help writers get this stuff right, and they will offer their services to you.
How's this full-time writing gig working out for you?
Oh, man, it's awesome. I love it. It's a little weird. You know, I've had a job my entire life, so now being a full-time writer, you know, you got to just set a schedule. You got to get up and put clothes on, wear pants, treat it like a job. No, it's worked really well, and I am so busy with, you know, I got so many books under contract. I've got so many anthology invites that I have no shortage of stuff to do. But, you know, being a full-time writer is just like any other job. You just got to kind of focus on it and set your schedule and, you know, sit your butt in the seat and actually work. I mean, it's very tempting to just play video games all day, but so far I've been really good. I wrote 75,000 words in 6 weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
last month. Well, I had a pretty... I wouldn't say harsh deadline, but I had a fairly stern deadline coming up. And I wanted to stay ahead of it because I'm leaving on book tour, so I'm going to be gone for basically almost a month straight on book tour. And it's almost impossible to get a lot of writing done on book tour. I mean, it's just impossible because you're just bouncing from town to town to town to town. So by the time you get into and you're doing events every day, so by the time you get to the hotel room at night, you just pass out. You just crash. So you don't really get writing done on book tour. So I'm going to be basically taking a month off to travel across America here, so I needed to get as much writing done before as possible. Just to, otherwise, I'm going to come home and I'm really going to be kicking myself. So, yeah, you just got. It's just like any other job, man. You got to pace yourself. You got to do what you need to do to fuel your creative juices, and then you just got to work.
What type of work, like writing habits, work best for you? In the morning, do you take breaks? How does that work?
Basically I do about, 8 o'clock in the morning. I'll start, I'll work through until about lunch, take, you know, usually a 30 minute break and then write until about either 3 or 4 or 5 in the afternoon, depending on how in the zone I am. Now, if I'm really in the zone and it's just, you know, the words are flying, I'm going to keep writing until I fall asleep. Usually I'll work until about 3 or 4 in the afternoon. I try to write about when I'm actually writing as opposed to doing other stuff, outlining, setting up projects, that kind of thing. Like an actual writing day, I'm going to try to knock out about 3,000 to 5,000 words in a day. But if I'm in the zone and I'm flying along, I'm not going to mess with that. I can do 8,000, 10,000 words in a day, but that's usually going to be about a 12-hour day. Most I've done is 16-hour days. But only when I'm desperate and have to get a project done really, really fast. So, but usually if you can average, a couple thousand words a day, I mean, you're great. So even when I still had my day job, I had a pretty intense day job. I was in military contracting. It was a high-stress job. I was a finance manager for a company. You know, it was a pretty intense, high-stress kind of career-filled job and working a lot of hours. Even then, I could still come home and I would, you know, maybe do 1,000 words in an evening, or I would edit during the evenings, and then on the weekends, I would try to write about 3,000, 5,000 words a day. I wrote 2 books a year for 5 years doing that. So, I mean, for the aspiring writers out there, it is achievable if you're just willing to set a schedule and stick to it and work at it religiously. I mean, it is totally doable and totally achievable. I mean, I'm not, people say that I'm prolific or that they think that I write really fast, and I really don't. It's just, I'm consistent. I say I'm going to do something, so I, you know, sit in the chair and write until it's done. I mean, I just put up a big blog post about, you know, writing habits on my blog and the stuff that you could do to be a professional writer. I mean, I'm pretty biased. Like, I think that writer's block is an excuse. I don't think it's real. I think really that's just the writer's bored or lazy. We want to go do something else. We're not feeling creative. We don't like this part that we're on. You know, that's fine. Just own up to it and be like, I don't want to work on this part. Go work on something else. Or this project is boring me. I'm going to admit that. I'm going to go work on a different project. Or I'm stuck on this chapter. I'm going to skip to this chapter and go write the next chapter that I know what needs to happen. I think if you do that, then you'll never have to worry about the whole writer's block. Oh my gosh, I'm so stuck. I'm so dumb. I think that's a trap. I think if you just work through it, you go do something else that you are interested in, or just admit that you don't want to write today and then go play some Call of Duty or Halo or whatever it is, have fun, you know, and then get back to work later. Do what you got to do. But, you know, don't be there all, oh, I have writer's block. Oh, I'm so dumb. I'm never going to make it as a writer. You know, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know. Give yourself some credit. You want to be a writer, be a writer. Just, you know, don't fall for the mystical BS that a lot of people put on themselves. I mean, basically, it's a job. You know, treat it like any other job. You'll make it. If you want to be a pro, treat it in a professional manner, and then you can do it. That's kind of how I look at it.
We'll link to that blog post in the show notes for this podcast so people can find that. So have you seen, I know you said that you wrote 75,000 words in 6 weeks. Have you seen almost like a breaking through the ceiling type of ability as far as production goes since you started writing full time?
No, I'm for the first time in 5 years, I'm actually taking days off. It's kind of crazy. I mean, it sounds silly to be laughing stuff, but no, it's quite literally true. We decided when I first quit my job, my wife said, well, you know what? You need to start taking Saturdays off so we can, like, do stuff once in a while. Because in prior years, I would take off maybe 1 or 2 or maybe 3 Saturdays in a year to, like, actually go do fun stuff. And so the first Saturday after I quit my day job, I'm sitting there, and I'm just sitting on the couch. I mean, I never watch TV. I just really don't watch TV hardly ever. And so I'm sitting there with my family watching TV, and I guess apparently I was just incredibly antsy, like moving around, like really just nervous and bored. And my wife looked at me, and she goes, okay, we're not doing anything interesting. Why don't you go write? I'm like, okay. So I hopped up and ran up to my office and, you know, worked on something. You know, that's one thing is, like, you know, if you want to find the writing time, sometimes you're going to have to sacrifice something in order to do it. But you got to do whatever it is you need to do for fun to keep your creative juices flowing. You know, don't beat yourself up. I mean, whatever it is you need to do to feel creative. If you need to go watch movies, you know, you need to go to the movie theater once in a while to charge up, do it. I paint miniatures, you know. I have to paint minis once in a while. I Sunday afternoons, I will sit there with my children and I'll paint miniatures. It's what I need to do to keep myself focused during the rest of the week.
So with Warbound coming out this fall, I read it, I loved it, especially Dan's character. I think that was definitely a favorite.
Oh yeah, that character was a cross between Dan Wells, the author, for those of you that know him. That guy was a cross between Dan Wells and Benedict Cumberbatch's version of Sherlock Holmes, was how I wrote that guy. So basically that was Dan Wells as portrayed by Benedict Cumberbatch.
He was a lot of fun to read about. I'm sure he was a lot of fun to write, too.
Yeah, he was, that was fun. That one was, because what it was Dan Wells has a book called, or I don't know if he's actually, if this is going to be the final title, but his working title is Extreme Makeover Apocalypse Edition. And it's a sci-fi novel about cloning. And in this book, he's got basically one of the antagonists is Larry Correa. It's just straight up me. And what it was is when he started working on this years ago, I was the biggest gun and tactics self-defense nut he knew. So he said, hey, Larry, if you were hired to lead a strike team of mercenaries for this ruthless mega corporation to do the following mission, how would you do it? And I was like, ooh, that sounds fun. So I sent him back this great big email. I was like, I would do this, I would do this, I would do this, I would need this, I need this, I need this. I sent him this big list, and Dan looks at it, he's like, holy crap, that's malicious. Can I just use you as the bad guy? And I was like, yeah. So years later, I'm working on this, and I needed this particular type of analytical character, and I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to use Dan. So I emailed Dan. I was like, Dan, if you could have a superpower, what would it be? And it went from there. But, yeah, I've used a lot of people that I know have shown up in my books. I believe, yeah, that's right. You were one of my charity red shirts, weren't you?
Yeah,
that's
I right. was killed in Spellbound.
Yeah, that's right. Heinrich beat you to death.
Yeah, which was awesome. It was great.
You got one of the best. Okay, so I do. For people who aren't familiar with this, when I say charity red shirts, what it is every now and then I'll do a charity thing where we'll have a cause, somebody needs help, and I will sell red shirts. So basically, you know, whatever the donation is to this, you donate to the charity. Then at the end, the charity informs me of your of some information about you, usually just your name, and I will squeeze you into my book and try to kill you. It was for a kidney transplant for a kid, and he's got a new kidney now. So that was cool. But man, you know, we had such a good response on the last one that I had red shirts for I believe 3 books. for that kidney transplant. And so you were in the scene with because I looked at Nick Sharp and I was like, that is the name of a guy who is a professional boxer. So I had this great fight sequence between a guy who normally has magical powers but was depowered, this German guy who's really, really tough, in a fist fight against 3 big burly guys in about a 10x10 prison cell. And it is one of the most violent fist fight scenes I have ever written, except it turns out that one of the 3 guys, Nick Sharps, is a former boxer who just beats the crap out of this character. And it is violent. It is a great action scene. So, yeah, you died well.
I did. I definitely did. So anyway, I meant to ask how it felt to finally wind up a series. I know that the Grimnoir Chronicles isn't necessarily over, but at least that the 3-part arc is sort of over. And I was wondering how it felt to actually finish a series of sorts.
That was weird for me actually, because I've never done that. It's the first time I've wrapped it, because Monster Hunter, there's an end in mind for the Monster Hunter series, but it's several books down the road. Grimnoir started out as a trilogy. I pitched it as a trilogy, and writing Warbound was a little weird because I've never actually wrapped up a series before, and it's a little different. It's a little weird because there's a lot of pacing decisions you need to make as the series goes on, because you know what you're shooting for. You know what you have to do. And I had a few people comment, I was like, oh man, I couldn't believe it was over. After they read Warbound, and I was like, dude, how do you think I feel? people were like, oh, it's good, though. If people are disappointed not the story wrapped up, but they're disappointed that the story wrapped up. They're not disappointed in the end, but they're disappointed that it had to end. You know, that's good for me because that tells me that I really connected with them and I really, they fell in love with this world and they didn't want to see it be over. But I do have more grim noir world novels planned. In fact, I've already sold two of them. I have two under contract to ban. One set in the 1850s when magic first appeared in the colonial world, and another one set in 1908 in New York City. And since then, I've actually had the idea and an outline for a whole other trilogy set in the 1950s, which would be kind of going along with like some of the golden age of sci-fi tropes. Some of the Heinlein-esque stuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that, well, and that one came about while I was writing Warbound. There's a sequence where Francis, who's one of my favorite characters ever, Francis is arguing with FDR. And then afterwards, Francis is talking to his financial advisor, who's actually Raymond Chandler, about this, and Francis is all angry. And Francis says, well, I'm going to run for president. Except at the time, the book takes place, he's like 24 years old. And Raymond Chandler goes, he didn't say dude, but he's like, you can't run to president until you're 35. And Francis is like outraged. He's like, what? When do they make that? And Raymond Chandler's like, oh, geez, you're certainly one of the product of our finest prep schools. Thank you, Francis. And but he's like, got it going. And Francis turned into such a political machine by the end of this series that I just thought it'd be really awesome in the 1950s to have Francis as president.
Absolutely.
Which avoiding spoiler alerts tells you who the first lady is. I looked at that and I was like, okay, I have to do this. And then, as I'm working on this, as I'm writing Warbound, I was like, okay, well, here's an unanswered question about how magic works. Here's an unanswered question about how this is going to happen. Oh, what's going to happen in the future when this and this, avoiding spoilers, come to a head? And I started looking, I was like, I really could write a whole nother series set 20 years later based upon the following few things, and I started sketching it out, and yeah, I'm going to have to do it in the future. It's too awesome not to.
I want to read it.
So,
oh, for sure.
Well, and then at the end, I can't, once again, avoiding spoiler alerts with who does what and winds up with who and who lives and who dies, but as you know, one of our favorite main characters at the very end of the book has a son. Okay, looking at that kid's parentage, that's going to be one heck of a character. If he takes after either of his parents, that's you know who I'm talking about. That could be awesome. I will squish you and set you on fire. But, so, I don't know, that's in the future. But right now I actually have, I've got 16 books under contract as of right now to be written. So, I'm booked up for basically the next 6 or 7 years. I'm good.
Before we go, Larry, you could just say the books that you've released this year and maybe plan to, and where people can find you online.
Sure. What I have coming up, I have Warbound, the third book of the Grim Noir Chronicles. Will be out August. I believe actually August 6th, and I'll be on book tour for that across America, Midwest mostly, coming city. And then I have Swords of Exodus, which is the sequel to Dead Sex, my military thriller with Mike Kupre. That will be out in September. And that is the two things I have coming out immediately. Those will be bookstores everywhere. Actually, if you go to any Barnes & Noble in America right now, they have a Larry Correa display this month. That's kind of cool. I had to go take my picture next to it. And I think that's about what I've got coming out. I don't have the release date yet on the Privateer Press novel. I believe that'll be out before the end of the year, but I don't have an official release date for that one yet. Oh, and then where to find me online, my just plug in Larry Correa or Monster Hunter Nation into your search engine, and it'll take you to my blog. It's larrycorea.wordpress.com. I will warn you, I do get a little political on there, so if you're thin-skinned, skip the political posts. That's all I will say.
And Do you know, is there going to be any kind of a schedule listed online for your book tour?
Yeah, I posted up one a little while ago. I'll post up another one again here coming up. I'm going to start in Minneapolis at Uncle Hugo's, and I'm going to work my way down America. I'm going across Ohio. I'll be stopping in, I think, three cities in Ohio. I'll be going into Kentucky, and speaking of Justified, I'll be going into Kentucky, and I'll wind up in Tennessee, and then I will be going to Indianapolis for Gen Con, and then I'll be on my way home. Oh, and Gen Con, I might mention this, another thing coming out, the Monster Hunter International role-playing game from Hero Games is available. I will be putting a link up on my blog. We launched that with a Kickstarter a little while ago, and those are all shipping now, so it's a great big, you know, 300-page role-playing game source book all about the Monster Hunter International universe. So, yes, I have my own role-playing game. I have achieved geek cred. Man, my nerd card is punched. I'm good to go. That is available now, though, from Hero Games.
Great. Well, if you stop through Des Moines, be sure to let me know. I'll take you out. That would be fun.
I'm trying to remember if I go through Iowa. I don't think I'm... I need to get this back up on the blog. Basically, I go where the publicist tells me to. I've got several more cons this year. I'm going to Huntsville, Alabama for Constellation. And I believe that's what I have left for this year. And then in January, I'll be going to Houston, Texas. So I will be going to Texas in January. They keep me bouncing around. I do like to tour quite a bit, so I travel.
Cool. Well, it's been great to have you on, Larry. You did a great job, Nick.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks again to our sponsor, Tracy Follaby, author of the fantasy novel Riss Rising, Book 1. You can find her at braveluck.com.
Visit Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing for show notes, links, reviews, special guests, videos, and more. Email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musically.com. No authors were seriously damaged in the making of this podcast.